SkyBus founder looks to bring back the ultra-low-cost airline. United takes a mulligan, and dark clouds loom over the labor showdown in Seattle. All that, including an interview with the airfare watchdog himself, George Hobica, Max's pick of the week, and more outtakes than you can shake a stick at on episode 14 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Greetings, everyone. Welcome back. Episode 14 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. This is Courtney. Thanks for joining us. With me, as always, is Max Flight.
Hi, Court.
How is everything going this week, Max?
Oh, terrific. I'm fresh back from vacation. Just can't wait to get back to work.
Well, it's a good thing that you're fresh because we do have a lot of news this week.
Yes, we do.
And even more exciting, we have a great interview with George Hobica. He's the founder of airfarewatchdog.com. Definitely not going to want to miss that, so make sure you stick around. Other than that, Max, what do you say we jump into the news?
I think we're ready to launch.
First up in the news this week, this coming out of the Springfield News Sun, that's Springfield, Ohio, airline eyes Springfield as new home. John Weichel, founder of SkyBus Airlines, the Columbus-based discount travel company that closed operations in April due to rising fuel costs and the lagging economy, is considering Springfield as a possible location to establish a new commercial airline. Changes at the airport would include improved and expanded taxiways, aprons, hangars, terminal areas, baggage handling, parking, and security. So, in effect, they've got some pavement.
Yeah. Do you think this guy's a glutton for punishment, or is this a great idea?
You know, I think he's a glutton for punishment. If you kind of follow what happened to SkyBus, and I know this guy was really frustrated in what typically happens in these startup companies, and that's he has a great idea, or what he thinks is a great idea. As he goes forward with it and finds funding, these people want to protect their investment by putting people in and changing the great idea to what they think is better off. So when it ultimately failed, which surprised nobody, you know, he was very frustrated in that he didn't really get to go forward with his vision. You know, fast forward to 2008, fall 2008, and he's talking to Springfield, Ohio, which I think is about 20 or 30 miles outside Dayton. You have to wonder why he would be talking to Springfield. And some people say it's because, you know, they like to go to off-the-beaten-path airports and this and that. I tend to think it's because Columbus got bit so badly when they went under that Columbus, Dayton, nor Cincinnati will talk to this guy. So Springfield has absolutely nothing there. I think it's a National Guard base. Could this be SkyBus 2? I don't know.
I guess we'll see.
Moving on to the next story real quickly then. And this was big news. We've talked about this, I think, before in the Airplane Geeks. The ice and fuel seen as culprit in January 17th Boeing 777 crash. This from the New York Times. British air safety investigators said Thursday that the Boeing 777 that crashed on approach to Heathrow's airport outside London on January 17th was most probably caused by ice within the fuel system.
Well, you know, it kind of made sense that since both engines were affected by this, in this incident, it would make sense that it was some common source of the problem as opposed to a particular problem with a particular engine that was repeated, as it turned out, you know, for the other engine.
They go on to say in the article here, the problem is apparently limited to 777s that are equipped with one type of Rolls-Royce engines, although investigators are looking at all other models as well. Boeing immediately recommended new procedures to British Airways, as well as to Delta, American, and other operators of 228 of the jets. These procedures call for pilots to run engines at higher than normal settings for brief periods to flush out ice that may be accumulating in the system.
Yeah, they looked at the the flight recorders from this aircraft, and they mapped out the temperature of the fuel during the course of the flight, as well as different thrust settings throughout the flight. And what they found was that there were periods of relatively low thrust levels corresponding to periods of extreme cold. I think the lowest temperatures were either 29 or 39 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. And so this recommendation kind of stems from the notion that, you know, ice can accumulate during these low thrust periods. And if you intersperse that with some, you know, short periods with higher thrust, that you kind of blow the ice out, as it were.
Now, a typical fuel heating system that are on aircraft is to use the oil from the engine, the hot oil, to warm up the fuel, which, in effect, it's the oil cooling system as well. I'm not certain if the 777 uses this. Do you know that, Max?
I don't think so. You know, there's always some water present in fuel, and it may be water in suspension. So in other words, dispersed throughout the fuel, or it could be just pools of water that'll sink to, you know, low points in the fuel tank. There's always some water in there, and there are different approaches taken to dealing with this, depending on the aircraft, and in some cases depending if it's military or civilian. But the I think the 777 uses a process for sort of scavenging and purging collected water out of the fuel. But you know, that just didn't happen here. The Air Accidents Investigation Branch, or the AAIB, in their report on this, in their interim report on this, and we should mention it really is the interim report, so the final word is not really available at this point. But they found some evidence of cavitation in the high pressure fuel pumps. Recent cavitation, which is what gave them the indication that there was some, you know, some icing that was causing a problem with the fuel flow. But you know, heating is another approach taken in some aircraft. Also, mostly in the military, although there are other applications. There are, you know, fluids mixed with it, like dry gas that you might put in your car engine. I don't think it's exactly the same stuff, but in concept, at least, it's similar to disperse the fuel, and that's another approach that's sometimes taken, but not typically in large commercial airliners.
The most disappointing part of this news story and how this kind of came about is that they're not certain, and I know there's really no way that they can be. At least if there were, I'm sure they'd find it. But it's always very difficult to say, we think this is how it happened. We're going to put in some procedures to fix what we think was the cause. And the only way to really know is if it never happens again. So I know they must be very frustrated in finding something that may have caused it, but they're not quite certain that that's what it is. It's much easier if you find a bird in the engine and you know that's what did it, than to not necessarily find an obvious culprit, and you're just kind of waiting for it to happen again.
Yeah, that's a good point. And this was a particularly difficult investigation in that area, because the parts of the aircraft and the engines that you'd want to look for contaminants, that you want to look for presence of water, those were the parts that were most compromised in the crash, either because of the damage due to the crash itself, or as a result of the firefighting efforts or response after the crash. You know, there's foam sprayed. There's also water was also used, apparently. So you can't really check the fuel because, you know, water was used in part to address the crash. So the evidence is going to be a little bit sketchy. But the report from the AAIB really contained three recommendations. And that gives you sort of a clue as to the level of understanding they feel that they have right now. The first recommendation was that Boeing and Rolls-Royce should introduce interim measures to reduce the risk of water ice causing a restriction in fuel feed systems. No, you know, help in terms of how to do that. just that Boeing and Rolls should do that. The second recommendation was that the FAA and the EASA, the European agency, should consider the findings of the interim report on other airframe and engine combinations, and I think that's what we've seen Boeing do. And then the third and final recommendation was that the FAA and the EASA should review the current requirements for certification to ensure that the tolerance to build up and release of ice in the fuel feed system is adequately covered. So those are the three recommendations that we have at this point.
And I still think the big news to come out of all of this is that a Boeing 777 crash landed, and some people didn't even know they had been in an accident.
That's amazing. That's not typical.
It is amazing that that airplane held together as well as it did. Moving on to another story, and this is just kind of a quick one, an update for what we had talked about last week on United. And sure enough, United Airlines on Tuesday said it has reversed its decision last month to start charging for food in economy class on international flights departing from one of its principal hubs. A United spokesman said the quick reversal came because of vocal feedback from the carrier's corporate and elite flyers, two groups that are heavy users of the airline and generate a huge chunk of United's revenue.
Thank God. I mean, somebody woke up.
Whoops.
Yeah, it is a flip-flop, as the article describes it. I like the quote from the pilots Tilton and his executives are out of touch with the needs of passengers. And I think that's true. I think actions like this would just alienate the flying public.
Okay, moving on to another story about the FAA, this from the New York Times as well. Federal aviation officials said Friday they are investigating 17 cases in which 11 air carriers did not comply with government safety directives. The first phase of the inquiry this spring found 7 instances in which 4 carriers had not complied with safety orders. FAA officials declined to identify the carriers and said they did not know if some of the new cases involved carriers already under investigation.
Yeah, we all want to see 100% compliance. The 17 incidents represents a 98% compliance rate, which sounds pretty good. I think if the people I work with were correct 98% of the time, I'd be pretty damn happy. But in the issues of flight safety, you certainly want to see 100% compliance.
Certainly, and I'll tell you, the statistic that really jumped out at me was they had 17 issues or 17 cases from 11 carriers. When you get to that many carriers who you're calling non-compliant, you have to start looking back at the FAA and saying, what is it with your systems that are not allowing this many carriers to comply? If it were, say, 17 cases across 2 carriers, then we need to look at those carriers. But I start to question, the policies themselves. This many carriers are not responding favorably to these safety orders.
Yeah, our industry can do better than this, and they should.
Okay, moving into our last story, and this is the biggie this week. This from the Seattle Times. That should give you a big clue. Strike has big risks for Boeing and the union. As the machinists union and Boeing management stare each other down over the contract vote Wednesday, the stakes are high for the company, its customers, and its suppliers, and also for the union leadership and rank-and-file workers. On Friday, the International Association of Machinists rejected Boeing's final contract offer and recommended a strike.
Yeah, this is, these things are always tough. No one likes a strike. I think everybody views it as sort of the action of last resort, but it's come to the last resort as far as the union and its membership are concerned. So we're into a strike now.
I did read another article, and I apologize that I don't have that source, but it was a commentary, and they talked about why they were not surprised that the union turned it down, and they mentioned there were some pension issues. But they said the big one was exactly what we talked about last week, and that is Boeing was not budging on their outsourcing.
Yeah, that's the workers usually see that as a threat. Seems to be viewed as being, sort of the opposite of job security, weakening job security. That's one viewpoint. There's another viewpoint, and we talked about that last week that it really you know, supports the strong company, which in the end supports employment. But yeah, there's definitely a ripple effect throughout the supply chain, and you know, but besides the, what's the figure you see quoted, 100 million a month in revenue loss. Besides that, this probably doesn't trigger penalties for missed deliveries of aircraft. Most of the contracts will have a clause that excludes the airframer from penalties on late delivery for certain kinds of events, and strikes usually fall into that same category, along with, you know, floods and earthquakes and so-called acts of God. So it wouldn't trigger that. But, you know, the impact on the 787 is probably one of the most visible impacts, and you know, no one really wants to see that delayed significantly as a result of the strike.
Good. So I'm sure we'll have more news on that in episode 15 of Airplane Geeks. But before we get to that, we do have a very exciting interview with George Hobica of AirfareWatchdog.com. Stay tuned for the main topic. For the main topic today, we'll be talking with George Hobica. He is the founder of AirfareWatchdog.com. If you have not checked it out, I suggest you do so now. In fact, pause the podcast, go check it out, and come back. We'll still be here because you're going to want to know all about what George does. George, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, certainly. Now, tell us a little bit about Airfare Watchdog.
Well, we're basically a low-fare listing and research site. We have a bunch of former travel agents and fare analysts who work for us, and they spend all day hunting down low fares, and when they find a low fare, they list it on our website, divided by departure airport. And we also include Southwest Airlines, which nobody else does, and the Allegiant Airlines, which nobody else has. And we also have promo code fares. For example, a little while ago, Virgin had a 2-for-1 promo code. You went to their site, plugged in a promo code, and two of you could fly for the same price as one person.
Now, I know that this has been kind of an issue for the travel agencies throughout time, is that Southwest cannot be included, and nor some of the other low-fare carriers, such as Allegiant. But how you get around that is you just have people go out and find the fares for you.
Right. They, you know, every airline actually has on their website terms of service, and the terms of service say you cannot scrape our fares. You cannot use mechanical means to scrape our fares because it slows down their website. If you're pinging their website, you know, every second on all their fares and all their routes, it's going to slow it down. So what we do is just once a day we go in manually with our agents and we see what Southwest is selling, you know, Providence to Orlando for. And do they fly nonstop? And what months of the year is it cheaper to fly on that route? And the same thing with Allegiant. So we don't overtax their system. We don't use scraping. We don't use, you know, robots. We just use, you know, people just like a journalist would if they were doing the Sunday, you know, fare chart for their travel section to see who had the lowest fare. So that's how we get around doing it. And the fact is that we don't make any money on Southwest. We send people directly to southwest.com, and the same thing with Allegiant. And a lot of the fares that we have, they're not monetized at all. I mean, obviously, somehow we have to make money. Somehow we have advertising. You know, some airlines pay us, you know, a few cents every time we send somebody to their site. But we list fares irregardless of who pays us. It's just who has the lowest fare.
And your website has a lot of other information for air travelers, right, in addition to the fares.
Right. Well, I started out as a travel journalist specializing in consumer affairs, and I still write for National Geographic Traveler and magazines like Real Simple, and I've written for Travel and Leisure, and most of that has been on the experience and the economics of travel, but especially more lately air travel. And that's what we do on the website, too. We have things like charts showing different fees for frequent flyer programs or sending bags in a hold or things like that. So we have a lot of consumer information. We have a question and answer column, and every day we answer a kind of a horror story or a question from a reader about something that happened or how they can, you know, deal with an airline where the airline has misbehaved.
But just kind of tell us about how Airfare Watchdog started.
Well, I started out as a journalist. I was actually working for a big corporation as a writer and later as an ad manager. And I was bored one day at work, and I noticed that my local paper had just started a travel section. So I wrote a letter, a regular snail mail letter to the editor, and I said, I'd like to be your new travel editor. So the next week I was, and still keeping my day job. And my editor got fired from the paper, and he went to America Online Digital City. Back then, this was like in the early 90s, each digital city had a staff in their local city, like Boston and Chicago and Miami. And he asked me to bring my column online and also to put up about 10 fares from Boston that seemed good, just like the local paper did every Sunday, except that we would do it every day. Because, you know, the newspapers put up fares just as a reference, but by the time the ink dries, the fare is gone or it's changed. So AOL noticed that it was getting a lot of traffic, and they scaled it up nationwide. And, you know, that was, for about 8 years, we were working for AOL's contractors. But as you probably know, AOL and Travelocity have a relationship, and they get a lot of money from Travelocity. And the problem was that we had fares that Travelocity didn't, for example, all the Southwest fares. So Travelocity kind of didn't like it, and they said, you have to bury these guys, and they did. They kind of hit us on the site, still keeping us because they knew it was a good product. And after about 8 years, they said goodbye, and I started working for some other sites like Sherman's Travel and Cheap Flights. But I didn't like the way that they were doing it because they didn't have all the fares and all the airlines. And I thought, you know, as a journalist, this is not really presenting the true picture, and a better job could be done. So I set out to, you know, again, recreate what I was doing for AOL, but on my own. And I started just with New York airfares. I just did it on my own. I did a list every day of good fares from New York, and it got picked up by, you know, like USA Today wrote about it, and the New York Times wrote about it, and said, oh, what the hell, I might as well expand it nationwide. And I rehired all my old buddies who were working for me when I was with AOL. And just got more and more popular, and as I kind of knew it would. And back in March, we actually sold the site to Expedia. So we're now a part of the Expedia family, and I'm still working for the site very happily.
You know, Cort, it kind of reminds me of the same sort of progression of events that we heard from Matt Daimler from, you know, Sea Guru. It's, you know, someone who's got a, you know, something they want to do for themselves, and it turns out they're good at it, and it just kind of grows and becomes, you know, very popular.
The moral of the story here, Max, is that this is a great idea that people have been willing to put a lot of work into, and it sounds like Expedia is doing a great job of bringing them all the great ideas into one place.
Yeah, yeah. George, can you tell us maybe, you know, if someone is looking to purchase plane tickets, kind of what's the process that you would advise consumers?
Well, I would advise them to do exactly what we do, and what we do is we first decide if we're flexible in our travel dates. I mean, do we really just want to save money, or do we have to go over, you know, February school vacation? And so we start with Travelocity or Orbitz or sometimes Cheap Air, and we use those sites because they have a very good, and you know, if I didn't mention Expedia, which is very interesting. We use those sites because they have a really good flexible date search. CheapAir.com and Travelocity.com will search domestic fares up to 350 days advance. So let's say you're thinking of going to visit, you know, your Aunt Agnes in Milwaukee in February, but then you see on Travelocity using a flexible date search that March is much, much cheaper. So maybe you'll change, you know, to March in order to save a lot of money. So we also, and then we look at Southwest. Now, Southwest Airlines serves a route. They may have a nonstop flight or a slightly lower fare, sometimes even a slightly higher fare, but it might be a nonstop. And, of course, Southwest doesn't have as many fees as the other airlines have, so maybe that's the best deal. So we actually go in and compare Travelocity, Orbitz, and Southwest, and sometimes Allegiant. And then, you know, I suggest that people sign up for all these newsletters and frequent flyer clubs that a lot of airlines have. For example, Virgin America has their flying club, which often sends out promo code deals, sometimes 20% off, sometimes 2-for-1. JetBlue has the same thing. They'll send out $30 off coupon codes or 10% off. And also Southwest has their ding fares, which are often cheaper than the regular published fares. Problem with that is you have to download a little applet, which sometimes slows down your computer. And also American Airlines has something called Deal Finder, which is also an applet. Same thing there. It tends to slow down the computer. They send out promo code fares. But we actually take the promo codes and we put them on our site and we calculate the fare with the promo code. And just to show you the depth that we go to, when American Airlines has a promo code on a certain route, let's say to Hawaii, we'll go in and plug the promo code in and calculate the fare and see if that really is the lowest fare. And then we'll go in Travelocity and say, okay, without the promo code, does another airline have a fare that's lower than American? So it's a lot of work, a lot of comparison. And that's what the average consumer has to do to save money on airfare. Or they can just come to our site, sign up for our newsletter alerts, and let us do the work for them.
Now, you mentioned, fees, and we were talking a little bit about that before. And on previous podcasts, we've talked about the airlines sort of increasingly making use of fees for services that had previously been included in the ticket price. How is the air traveler to kind of understand what the total cost of flight is with this sort of complicated, mishmash of different fees?
Well, luckily, there are lots of charts on the Internet. Now, if you Google airline fees or airline fee charts, you'll see that a number of sites have tallied all these fees. We have one as well, and Smarter Travel, a sister company, has some charts that we help them do. So you look at the chart, and you can see all the airlines together and look at your situation, how many bags you're planning to carry with you. The thing with bags is sometimes the checked baggage fees can be higher than your airfare, and I'm not exaggerating, especially if you're overweight, not mm-hmm. you, but your bag, and oversized. And we're talking sometimes like hundreds of dollars each way for fees. What I'm telling people now, and I practice what I preach, if you're staying in just one place, why not just put everything in a box and take it to FedEx or, FedEx Ground, take it to your Kinko's and send it FedEx Ground or UPS Ground. 3 or 4 or 5 days before your arrival, you can send it to your hotel, you can send it to your grandma's place, you can send it to your, branch office, and you'll pay a lot less. And believe me, if UPS or FedEx loses your shipment, they're going to be a lot more responsible about it than most airlines are.
Hmm. Great tip.
So that's one way to get around the baggage fees. Also fly Southwest Airlines because they have lower fees. They don't have no fees, but they're not going to charge for the first and second bag. Continental Airlines just joined the club by announcing a $15 first bag fee each way.
Right.
And they have a $25 second bag fee. So that's one way. Another fee that's been popping up is the frequent flyer fee. It used to be a frequent flyer ticket was free. But now you have to pay taxes and last-minute issuance fees and change fees and just issuance fees. Like, just a standard fee for a frequent flyer ticket can be anywhere between 25 or 50 or even more, even if it's not a last-minute request. So frequent flyer tickets are no longer free, unfortunately.
George, you mentioned earlier before we started the podcast that you had done a couple of surveys that were kind of interesting.
Right. Actually, one fee that, according to a survey we did, one fee that airline passengers would gladly pay for, not gladly pay for, but they would pay for, is to have a child-free flight. Apparently, people are just sick and tired of kids screaming and kicking and wailing on their flight and ruining their flight, especially if the flight's delayed and, a 6-hour transcon flight is suddenly a 10-hour flight. And I understand that kids, they can't control it. So I asked people, first of all, do you think that airlines should have a separate cabin or a separate section in the plane for kids, babies, and their parents? And 85% of 20,000 respondents so far have said yes, that they would like to see a separate cabin. So then we asked them, how much extra would you pay for a child-free flight? Let's say, the 8 p.m., departure is child-free. And surprisingly, 51% so far have said that they would pay something. Most said they'd only pay $10 each way, but 7% so far have said they'd pay anything to fly in peace.
Wow.
That's interesting. Now, George, this is something that we do for all, well, for most of our guests. We did skip a few, but we're not about to let you off the hook, and that is word associations. Max and I each have a couple words, and the rules of the game are just say the first thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
We can start simply. Just cheap flights.
Southwest Airlines.
I'd say still the low cost option, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, the total flight is going to be cheap because you're paying fewer fees for things like, you know, unaccompanied minors. They don't charge for in the first and second bag. So, you know, it's cheap. The total flight is the total fare now is not just what you're paying for the fare. It's for the entire flight for all the stuff that other airlines charge for. For example, bottled water or, you know. Soda, you know, U.S. Airways is now charging for soda. So you have to look at the total cost.
Exactly. Okay.
Okay. My first word then, or series of words, travel agent.
Still very useful, and especially if your flight is canceled or delayed, it's much easier to, you know, get on the phone, on your cell phone, while the flight is taxiing back to the gate because, you know, a little light went on in the cabin to, call your travel agent and ask them to rebook you on another flight or to get you a hotel room if you're going to be spending the night. And now they could find low fares for you too. They charge now for the services, but for a lot of people, you know, time is money. And if you're spending 2 hours to find a low fare and you have a great travel agent, why not call the travel agent and have her or him do the work for you?
Okay. My next word is actually four words: passenger bill of rights.
We need one. Absolutely. It's time for a passenger bill of rights, and the airlines get away with murder, and in Europe they actually have a passenger bill of rights. It's much more effective. You know, the Europeans have been writing laws much longer than we have, so I guess they're more advanced, but we need some kind of passenger bill of rights because the airlines industry is going amok. It's running amok. You know, the thing is, yeah, I know the airlines aren't running money, but the product has become so bad, and they keep on raising all these fees. It's like if you went to, you know, your favorite restaurant and they reduce the portion and they start to, like, oversalt everything and burn it, and then they charge you more. You wouldn't go back. And, you know, that's why air travel in this country is down besides the economy. People are just sick of it. They're driving, taking the train. I mean, I take the train when I go to Boston or New York from Boston or Washington here from New York because I would never fly. You know, it's, like, too much of a hassle. That's a sad thing coming from somebody who runs an airfare website, I guess.
No, but we understand exactly what you mean. Okay, my next word is, let's see, ancillary revenue.
Well, you know, if the airlines are making millions of dollars on all these ancillary fees, and that's a good thing. They should make money. I want the airlines to make money. But unfortunately, we're only talking hundreds of millions of dollars, and that sounds like a lot, but they're losing billions and billions of dollars. So these fees are going to piss people off, and they may not really close the gap, the financial gap that needs to be closed. Unfortunately, the best way for the airlines to do that is to cut capacity, which they're doing, and to raise fares. The problem is, of course, once they raise fares, demand is going to drop off. There are some trips that simply are not necessary, or they're optional. You know, the only things trips that I can think of that are not optional, going to funerals perhaps, weddings, honeymoons, even those are optional. Going to college is probably the one I think of the most as being, you just have to do it. Even business travelers, you know, they can do video conferencing or, you know, try to seal a deal on the phone. So ancillary revenues are, you know, I don't think they're going to be enough to save the airlines.
Okay, my next word, my last word, is hurricanes.
Well, hurricanes are, you know, going to get worse and worse, they tell us. And probably if you're traveling during hurricane season, you want to go below the hurricane belt. So you want to go to the ABC Islands or go someplace where there aren't hurricanes. The ABC Islands are, what are they, Bonaire, Curacao, and Aruba.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's avoid, you know, San Juan. Let's avoid Florida. You know, unfortunately, the airlines really can't do anything for you in a hurricane. A lot of times people are stranded and there aren't enough hotel rooms and you're going to end up on the floor, you know, the airport floor. So I would suggest not traveling to the hurricane belt during hurricane season.
Good. Then the last one should be no surprise if you've heard us before. That's Airplane Geeks.
Airplane Geeks. Well, I'm an airfare geek, and most of the people who work for us are too. Even the travel agents. We have like two or three travel agents. So I appreciate geeks. In fact, one of our main people who helps with our technical side, his father was a pilot. And I used to work for Eastern Airlines, which is now dead. So, and I used to ask my father when I was a kid to bring me to Logan Airport. I was born in Boston, so I could watch the planes take off and land. So how's that for being an airplane geek?
That I think that definitely qualifies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So good. George, thank you so much to all of our listeners. Make sure you go check out airfarewatchdog.com. Tons of things you can do there. I see message boards. You've got your newsletter, of course. You've got your top fares from, looks like, just about any airport you could think of in the U.S., and even have a nice little airline route map section. So
yes, actually, we have the most complete set of links to official airline route maps on the internet, and so it's growing all the time. And also, we have newsletters and fare alerts. People can sign up for fare alerts on specific routes, and when an airfare goes down to a level that we think is really great, we will send you a notice by email.
Great.
So you guys better sign up.
Yeah, in fact, that's what I'll be doing as soon as we finish the podcast.
Cool, thanks. Let me know how the user experience is.
Absolutely. George, thank you so much once again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, George.
And as always, like clockwork, Max Flight has his pick of the week.
Yeah, Court, my pick this week is David Palermo Photography. David is an amazing photographer that's done a lot of work at the Smithsonian and in other places. But what I particularly like about some of his Smithsonian work is what he's done is he's gotten into the cockpits of aircraft that you'll find at the museum that you can't get in. Because many of them are hanging from the ceiling or otherwise are not, open for visitors. He's taken some amazing panoramic images from inside the cockpit. And I think the technology that he uses is a camera that actually rotates and takes a series of pictures. And so you see in one print the entire cockpit. And these images take on a highly artistic quality. I mean, besides documenting the interior of the cockpit, they're really works of art in their own right. And he's got things like the Gemini 7 space capsule. One of my particular favorites images is the B-29 Enola Gay cockpit. He's got the Concorde. Some other space capsules, the Lockheed Martin X-35, and some others. The photography is just worth looking at, just to enjoy. If you're looking for some artwork for an office area, for example, this might be fantastic for that. If you'd like an aviation theme, in the office area. So I recommend that. It's David Palermo Photography. His website is DavidPalermo.com. That's DavidPalermo.com. And look for the Smithsonian link to see these images.
And I'd spent some time on his website. It's kind of difficult to explain and describe exactly what these pictures are. The best way I could do it is, imagine that he took the cockpit, sliced it open, and then just kind of flattened the whole thing
out.
Yes,
exactly.
It's an amazing, first of all, the quality is fantastic, and it's an amazing perspective in these cockpits, as if you were looking all around and you were able to just kind of lay it flat. Again, as Max said, you can buy some of his photography. If you do, of course, please mention that you heard of David on Airplane Geeks. We did have a voicemail from Dan Webb this week, and he gives us a little more insight into the Zoom shutdown from last week.
Hi, Court and Max. This is Dan Webb calling in. Just a couple comments after listening to episode 13. First, on Zoom, just an interesting fact. There are actually two Zooms, one based in Canada and one based in the UK. And that allowed them to do transatlantic service from both the U.S. and Canada. I think you guys were wondering, you know, what's the market share for transatlantic travel for American carriers. And actually, I remember, I believe Delta's CEO was on CNBC a few weeks ago, and he actually said that most of the international traffic out of the U.S. is on foreign carriers, if I recall correctly, which is why American carriers love Lufthansa so much. You know, it's a merger without a merger, because a lot of governments restrict foreign ownership of airlines. Moving on to alliances, just onto the American-British Airways deal, and also with Iberia, and I believe Finnair and Royal Jordanian are in there too. You know, I think this should be allowed through. I mean, SkyTeam and Star Alliance already have antitrust immunity. You know, Oneworld should be able to have it too. And I think there could be some benefits for consumers. It could make booking easier for some of them. Apparently, there might be some frequent flyer program benefits if this deal goes through. I'm not sure about that. But also, it just makes, you know, transferring between airlines easier. Like, if I recall correctly, I was in Paris back in April, and Delta and Northwest were able to use the same terminal that Air France used at Paris, which made it a lot easier for passengers to change between airlines. It, you know, just made everything a lot more convenient. Also, just speaking about Delta and Northwest, since you guys were talking about labor issues last week, that's a labor issue I'm very interested about, because Northwest is very unionized, but Delta, only their pilots are unionized. So then the Northwest union seem concerned about what's the future of those unions with the merged carrier. And I think that's an issue that we're going to have to look at as time progresses. But also, just one comment about the unions, you know, I think it's always going to be an issue in the airline industry. And unfortunately, it looks like, you know, the only time management and the unions can get along is when the airline is doing well financially. I mean, for example, Southwest is very heavily unionized, and you really don't see that many problems between management and the unions, just because, you know, Southwest has been very successful financially. But anyway, that's it for me, and hope to talk to you guys soon. Bye.
And don't forget, you can send your voicemails. The number is 812-757-4252. Call it on a phone. You can even call us on Skype. And leave a voicemail. We'll get you on the podcast. Of course, there's always email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And our website, which I was going to say earlier, which is airplanegeeks.com. Come visit us. Leave some comments. We do have some discussion that goes on about the podcasts. And we do appreciate you coming for that. You can send us an MP3 recording yourself. We'll get you on the podcast. Give us a call at the voicemail. Again, that number is 812-757-4252. You can vote for us on Podcast Alley, Dig, leave us a review on iTunes. Those are all great ways to show your support for the Airplane Geeks. Also, the best way is to just tell your friends about us. Our downloads keep increasing week over week, so we owe that all to our listeners, and that you're spreading the word. And also, if we are going to start looking into sponsorships, so if you're interested in sponsoring us, please make sure you give us an email or send us an email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So other than that, a big thanks again to George Hobica, to Bruno Mazan, and to Brother Love for our beginning and ending music. Anybody else I should be thanking besides yourself, Max? Thank you for joining me again.
You can thank me, and I'll thank you.
You're very welcome, Max. So, also, if you have suggestions for Pick of the Week, make sure you send them to us, and we'll go out and check them. And if Max deems they're worthy, we'll get those on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Other than that, Max, I think episode 14 is concluded.
I think it's a wrap.
I think it is. Join us next week for episode 15 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'll see you guys.
Bye, everybody.
Don't forget that you can send your voicemails, 85... Excuse me. Crap. that's my home area.
You can call Court at home. If his wife answers the phone, be nice.
Okay, it's Dan again. This is take number two, because I forgot some things.
Should I mention, Max, about them sending in suggestions for pick of the week?
Oh, sure, yeah. And if they're dumb, we can ignore them.